Good evening. My name is Barney Morris, and I'm an alcoholic. And it is nice to be here tonight. I really have come to believe that it's a real privilege when I am asked to participate in any way in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, or indeed just attending a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is a privilege for me these days. And particularly when I think about the sort of theme that that Clancy's been developing in his talk the last couple of months, which is to talk a little bit about the history of AA, when I think about the coincidences that he mentions and the people that he mentions who had to get together at just the right place at the right time for all of us to be here, I really feel very grateful because, today in Alcoholics Anonymous there are so many meetings everywhere that you can practically roll out of bed and fall into one. And had I been around and drinking in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, I doubt very much if I would have had the opportunity to even find a meeting, and if I'd found one, I wouldn't have stayed, and it would not have been as easy for me. And it had to be easy for me to do this, believe me, because I was very reluctant to be a member of AA. I was reluctant to be in the meetings for a real good reason. I think I was alcoholic. And it seems like kind of a weird place to be if you're not an alcoholic. Struck me that way anyway. I want to welcome you if you're new to AA. And if you're sitting there and you're kind of uncomfortable about just being here, and you feel the drinking isn't really the problem anyway, and you've had a lot of pressure in your life and a lot of problems, and if you just could get those solved, get those things resolved, that you'd be okay, and it's just that those people out there keep looking at you funny, and when you drink, you look alcoholic, so they make the mistake of thinking that you are. And if you're reasonably sure that this is just a lot of baloney and you're not going to hang around, I just want to welcome you, because those are the feelings that I had when I came in here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because the heat was on and because I had a lot of difficulty in my life, a lot of problems. I owed a lot of money. My wife had divorced me. I was thousands of dollars in debt. I was tired. I was very tired. If I had one way to describe myself when I got here is I was just tired. I was just beat. Because I had spent I was 35 years old, and I had spent most of the years of my life trying desperately to be successful, trying desperately to be something. Because I knew somehow from the time that I was very small that I just didn't want to be nothing. I grew up on the south side of Chicago in an Irish Catholic neighborhood where they didn't know a hell of a lot about psychiatry, and we didn't have a lot of money. I guess my dad made about $8,000, the best year he ever had. We didn't know that we were lower middle class, just because everybody else in the neighborhood was in pretty much the same shape. But I can remember going to the South Shore Country Club when I was a kid and looking through the iron gate and seeing those guys in the knickers in there and the fancy cars and the golf clubs and stuff, and thinking, gee, I'd like to be like that. And I can remember going to lots of movies when I was a kid and seeing people that actually lived in houses that they owned. Because I grew up in an apartment, and all the buildings in that neighborhood were apartment buildings, and people actually lived. I never met anybody, never actually met anybody who lived in a house that they owned until I was 18 years old, went to college. But I knew that I wanted to be somebody, and I wanted to be successful, and I wanted to be rich and famous. That's all I ever wanted. And I had a sense of desperation about it. The problem was that as I became an adult and as I started to work, I had some success and I was doing well and things were moving along for me. And even when I was successful, even when things were going well, I had a sense that I was going to lose it all, and it was going to go away somehow, or I wasn't going to get the next thing, and I wasn't going to make my next move. And my next move for me, I got in the radio business out of college and moved into television. And by the time I was 26 years old, it just blows me away when I think about it, but when I was 26 years old, I was the anchorman for a television station owned by ABC in Detroit. And I looked successful. By that time, I had a wife, and I had kids, and I had a home, and I had cars, and I had clothes, and I had stuff. My measure of my success has always been the accumulation of stuff. How much stuff can I accumulate? Because if I get more stuff than the next guy, I look better than he does. I'm more successful, and I'm doing better. And it was always important for me to have stuff. And so I accumulated a lot of stuff, and I had all the things. And even then, even as I was moving along there in my late 20s and successful and being flown to New York and taken to the New York Hilton, being put up at the Leonard Goldenson suite in the New York Hilton, flowers in the room and champagne in the room and show tickets and whatever the hell we wanted, because the ratings were good, whatever the hell we wanted. Even then there was that sense of, God, when am I going to make my move? When am I going to really be successful? How am I going to get out of this trap I'm in? And move it on and just be somebody. Because I'm in Detroit, for God's sake. Just, Jesus. Gotta get to a bigger town. I gotta be something. I don't know whether I was a social drinker in my early years or not. I never drank very much of anything until I was 21 or 22. And I can remember a guy I worked for a little radio station then in Toledo. And I had a couple of martinis one day for lunch and came back to do a couple of 5-minute newscasts in the afternoon. And I was slurring my words. And the general manager called me in and he said, "What the hell's the matter with you?" And I said, "Well, I had a couple of martinis for lunch and I guess that's probably the thing." And he said, "Look, I'm going to tell you something, Barney. Alcohol has destroyed more careers in this business than anything I know. So if you're smart, you will never, ever, ever drink before a show. Now, after work, go out and drink all you want. Just don't drink before a show." You know, I never broke that rule. I had a lot of rules about drinking, but that was the main one. I don't drink before a show. I don't drink till after work. And as I hit my stride in my mid-20s and began to make some money, I began to go out and find the saloons after work. Seemed like a good place to relax and have a couple drinks and take the sharp edges off and just kind of calm down and hold court. Hold court with people who wanted to be near me. Now, I thought that way, and I didn't think there was anything wrong with thinking that way. But it was funny, because even in the days when I was surrounded by people who just wanted to be there with me, even in those days, I just felt like nothing. I just thought, Jesus, if they only knew. If they only knew how dumb I really am. If they only knew how I really haven't got it. I haven't got it. I can't make it. And I know something's wrong. I know what the hell's the matter with me. Well, I'm a moral leper. I knew that. I had rejected God. I had Roman Catholic education all the way through college, but I'd rejected God and the notion of God because I never had what our book calls a conscious contact with God. I didn't have that. And when I first read the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I saw that phrase in there. And I thought, oh, God, that's it. That's what I haven't got. And if you got to have it here, I'm screwed. Because I can't get that. Conscious contact. I can have conscious contact with the people in the front row. I can have conscious contact with people even on the telephone. I can have conscious contact with people all the time. But with God? Him? No. Impossible. So there's something missing in me. Just something not quite right about me. And I knew that. But I never could tell anybody that. Because you got to look good out there. If you're going to be a success, you got to look good. You got to look like you got it together. You can't tell them you're scared. If you tell them you're scared, they'll know you're not a man to begin with. And they'll just kind of understand that you're just a wimp and a nothing and all the things that I felt about myself. So I spent a lot of time trying to look good, and I spent a lot of time drinking in those saloons. And somewhere along the line, I don't know when, I started to overshoot the mark. I started getting real drunk a lot. Just about every time I drank. And I never had a 502. I drove drunk all the time. Never had a 502. That was one of my reasons for not being an alcoholic. I came into AA and I heard people talking about drunk driving, getting 502s. I never had one of those. I never was hospitalized for alcoholism. I never drank in the morning, unless I was still drinking from the night before. I didn't drink every day. I was reasonably periodic, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week. But I didn't drink every day. Didn't drink on weekends. Never started drinking at home. Never. Never. I would finish drinking at home a lot. But if I was sitting there on the weekends and things were happening and I was with the kids and I was being daddy and I was being a husband and I was being that responsible person I always wanted to be, really, but knew I couldn't be somehow. But I was acting that way. Act as if. I knew about that long before I got to AA. But I never drank at home and stuff like that. I was going to take the kids to Y Indian Guides and Little League and do all the right stuff. Cut the grass and take out the garbage and do, you know, the things I saw other people doing. But I wasn't like those other people, and I knew that. I was different, and I was weird, and I was strange, and I was just probably a cut above them most of the time. But in some cases, if they were really bright or if they were really successful, I was a cut below them. I just never felt equal, I guess. But see, I didn't know about that, and I didn't put those kind of labels on things, and I didn't identify feelings. I didn't walk around thinking, aha, I'm experiencing fear today. Aha, my anxiety level is up. I never talked about stuff like that. Feelings and emotions and stuff like that were things I just never thought much about. You know, psychiatry was something for the movies. That was just baloney stuff for people that can't handle themselves. Guys that can't get out there and do it. I thought I was doing it. My career moved me on to Los Angeles, and I was working here. And in 1972, my wife divorced me because she thought that I was an alcoholic. Now, I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. How can you be an alcoholic? For God's sake, I voted. I had a home in Woodland Hills. I had cars. I had clothes. I had a good job. I was a well-known guy. Everything was moving along. It was okay. What the hell's the matter? I can't be an alcoholic. Of course, I drink a lot. However, I'm in a job that is so pressure-filled that I almost can't bear it most of the time. The anxiety that I feel just about the next young guy that walks in the door scares the hell out of me because he wants my job, and I want his job. And I'm trying to figure out how to maneuver and how to make it happen and how to do it all. And of course I drink. It's part of the job. It's part of the business. It's part of showbiz. Get out there among them. But she divorced me. And I was frightened by that because the judge decided that the house should be sold and the two lawyers split what was left. I didn't have any credit left. They'd taken my credit cards. And I remember the guy coming for my MasterCard. I was in my swimming pool with my children. That was a rotten time for him to pick, and I said, send him out here. I'll discuss it with him. And I was in the pool, and he came out. And he said, we got to have your MasterCard. And I said, get me my wallet. Remember my wallet? I handed him the MasterCard, and I said, here, out of here. And I threw it at him, and that's where I was. I owed thousands of dollars. And I ended up in an apartment in Santa Monica with my 6 kids. Because one day I stood up in all of my alcoholic might and said, I demand custody of those children. And she said, okay. Jesus. I was really frightened, and I was really depressed, and I was just tired. I was tired. I'd beaten my way through the world out there for 35 years, and I was tired and scared. And I thought, the hell am I going to do? Now, some months earlier, I'd met a guy who told me he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said to me that he hadn't had a drink in 4 years. That impressed the hell out of me. Because I figured he was an alcoholic, it's probably good that he didn't drink. But I knew that if I was going to get my act together and get those bills paid and get my thing organized to the point where I could put it together one more time and get my career moving and get successful again, then I'd be all right. But I had to quit drinking for a while to do that. And I had a little problem about that because I had tried to stop drinking many times. If the heat was on and the screws were coming down on me because of some bizarre incident or some crazy thing that happened, or my wife was upset, or I was hungover so bad I couldn't see straight anymore, something would happen and I'd quit drinking for a while. I did it over and over and over and over again. Now, something very odd happens to me then. When I stop drinking, the pressure of my job, the anxiety of living, the frustration of just trying to be out there in the world and survive begins to get to me. I get nervous. I get frustrated. I feel a lot of anxiety. I just don't like it. I can't deal with it. And without that anesthetic to ease it off, I don't know what the hell to do. I have to drink sometimes because it's the only goddamn thing that makes me feel good. Why do you drink so much? Because it makes me feel better. That's why. And if I stay sober too long, I get crazy. I would not have described that as a drinking problem. I would describe it more as a sobriety problem. Where are you going to go with that? Sobriety's Anonymous? Sure, I've got to learn to control the drinking. Sure, I've got to learn to keep it within certain bounds. And I can do that. It's just a matter of, it's just going to take me some time. But I got to get the money going. And I got to get the cars going. And I got to get the stuff going. And then I'll be okay. I'll be all right then. But I call this guy, drunk. I told him my wife had divorced me and I was just screwed. Life had just screwed me. And I had this problem about, I couldn't seem to keep from drinking. I could make 4 or 5 days alone. But after that, it just got to the point where I just had to drink again. And I said, if you could just tell me what it is that you, because he got 4 years. I said, if you could tell me what it is that you do here and explain it to me, I'll get it, and then I could do that, and then I'll be all right. And I can quit for a while, and I can put it together, because I'm not really alcoholic. Not really. It's just, I just look that way when I drink. And a lot of people make that mistake. But I'm not really. And so he suggested that we start going to meetings. And I said, I can't do that. He said, why not? I said, do you know who I am? I work in television over here. You know what that could do to my career? To walk into one of those open gatherings with them? Jesus. And among other things, he said, well, how much is it doing for your career dancing on them tables at 3 o'clock in the morning? And I wondered how he knew. And he talked and he talked. He just seemed to think it was really important that we go to this stupid meeting. And I couldn't talk him out of it, and I needed some help. I said, all right, we'll go to the meeting. So we went to the meeting. Went to the men's fag in Beverly Hills. And all these guys get up one pitch after another, 3-minute pitches, bang, 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 one after another. That's what they call barefoot AA there. Didn't impress me. I didn't like it particularly. Some of the stories were kind of interesting, but some of these guys got in a lot of trouble. Jesus. Bad drinkers. And they gave me this book, and I took it home and kind of leafed through it. There was a lot of God stuff in it, and it looked simple and sophomoric and just not right for a guy like me. I needed something really incisive. And this thing was just kind of really archaic language, and I found out in 1939, come on, you know. 1972, you know, isn't it? Different era now. I thought maybe they had another book for bright people. And after the meeting, the coffee shops, endless coffee shops, endless conversation about themselves. Nobody seemed to want to hear my case. Well, let me tell you how it was when I got here. How long have you been sober? 28 years. Oh, Jesus. And this guy then wanted to go to another meeting the next night. I said, you need to do this every day? He said, oh, yes, you're going to really get into this thing. He was a nice guy, and I liked him a lot, but I was scared enough to do it. I mean, just scared enough to do it. I know what the hell to do. I'm not alcoholic. What are you going to do? Got to go someplace. You got to figure something out. Got to quit drinking for a while. So I went to the meetings, asked this guy to be my sponsor. That was a mistake. Because he had things he wanted me to do. Wanted me to mop the floors of the Ohio Street meeting on Tuesday night. That was the Pacific Group meeting then on a Tuesday night. And I mopped the left side of that floor. I go, what the hell am I doing this for? And I don't understand. I said, what's this got to do with staying sober? He said, it's good as part of the action toward recovery. I don't understand that kind of stuff. I was a greeter on a Thursday night meeting. I was making coffee at a meeting. I was just, he got me really doing stuff. When I was 6 months sober, he told me that they needed a secretary at a little recovery home in the valley. And I went out to the meeting with him, and there were about 12 guys sitting in there, you know. And you could tell they weren't sincere. I mean, if I'm going to be secretary of a meeting, I mean, let's make it a meeting. Not 12 guys in a recovery home. Come on. Monday night, once a month, I used to take... He got me hooked into this thing of taking speakers up to Camp Acton on Monday nights. That's a long damn drive up there. Seemed to me that I'd have somebody closer to Camp Acton to do that. Made sense to me. Take the speakers up there, and sometimes three or four guys would come because they had bingo the same night. And that's a poor farm for alcoholics out there. They're all supposed to be alcoholics, and they're playing bingo. And I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm driving to this goofy meeting. One night I took two speakers up there, and one guy showed up. And I was apologizing to these speakers. I said, Jesus, I'm really sorry. I drove you guys all this way to talk, and one guy shows up. I said, I don't know what to do. And then one guy said, well, have him read chapter 5, and we'll have a meeting. Crazy stuff. I didn't understand any of this. So I just keep doing it, and I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm getting crazier by the day because my sobriety problem kicked in bad right after I quit drinking. I was nervous and edgy and anxiety-ridden and frustrated and full of pain and listening to stuff at meetings that didn't make any sense to me.
Everything's going to be all right. Oh, really?
Not in my house, baby. I just couldn't connect anything. Nothing made sense. 7 months sober, I was sitting at Ohio Street on a Tuesday night, and Clancy got up to talk. Now, Clancy was not a man I liked much. He was, he seemed to be not very, very kind to me sometimes. And he seemed to have a lot of control over people. And that bothered me. Because as I thought about it later, what I really wanted was that I would have that kind of control. Why don't they follow me around like that? Listening to my words. When nobody ever did. And I just, I wanted to leave the meeting, except my sponsor, Keith, was sitting in the front row. And I had, Jesus, you gotta stop and explain it to him, right? Where are you going? Well, I got to head to the... And forget it. I sat there. Too much trouble. So I sat there and I listened. And what happened was that I'm listening to that kind of jaded, arrogant sense of Yeah, what are you going to tell me, pal? And he threw me a curve. Because I don't identify with his story at all. I don't identify with his drinking pattern. Jesus, he left families in mailboxes all over America, and he had his teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank and couldn't sell his blood on Skid Row. That's not my pattern. Jesus, I didn't drink like that. What I identified with was how he felt. I identified with the fear that he was talking about, and the anxiety that he talked about, the frustration he talked about, and the sensitivity that he talked about, and the loneliness that he talked about. First, I was embarrassed for him. Because you don't tell people that stuff. A whole room full of people, and he's telling them how weak he is. I mean, that's not the way you get along in the world, and I know that. And yet he was doing it. They thought it was funny. They're sitting there laughing and carrying. I sat there, and the more I thought about it, the more I understood why I was so embarrassed for him. I was embarrassed for him because I knew what he was talking about. I knew it just right down to the depths of my soul how he felt. And I knew that I felt that way and had felt that way many times. And I didn't know what the hell to do about it. And he said, if you're walking around with a set of emotions, anything like what I'm describing, and you seem somehow unable to control and enjoy your drinking, there's a name for that. It's a disease called alcoholism. I was really surprised. And I think I said something to him after the meeting. I said, Jesus, if what you're saying is true, I may be alcoholic. He said, how long have you been around here? I said, 7 months. He said, God, you're a quick study. Now I know I'm in the right place. I don't like it any better, but I know I'm here. Now I try to read the book. A lot of God stuff. Can't handle that. Forget it. My higher power was my sponsor, I decided. Because Keith said to me one day, we were talking about it, and he said, look, you can have any higher power that you want to, Barney, as long as you're reasonably sure it isn't you. And so I made it my sponsor. And he said, I don't think you ought to do that because I may get drunk tomorrow. And so I thought about that later and I thought, yeah, he's right about that. So I made it my group. That was my higher power. Everybody ain't going to get drunk the same day. So it was my group. And later I decided to really expand it. So that my higher power became all of the alcoholics around the world, linked together in spiritual sobriety. And I hung on that for a long time. What it did, it got me through step three. And at least to the degree that I was able to get through step three. And it got me into four and five and on through the steps, and I felt like I was doing something. Well, I married a woman here in this group. And she had two children. And I had six children, and we put these eight kids together. And I got a big-time job offer back east, and Carol and I moved back east, and I was going to work for CBS back there, and I was going to be big time. And now my career was going to move, because I'd been sober a couple of years. And now things were going to happen. And now I was going to get my reward for being sober. It was time for me now. And so I went back there, and I was busy being rich and famous. And I decided I didn't like the meetings back there very well. They don't know how to do this thing, I decided. It's different. And so I started a meeting of my own, California style. We read chapter 5, and we said hi to the speaker. They didn't do that most of the meetings I went to. They said, my name is Barney, and I'm an alcoholic. And they all sit there and go, But that was about the only meeting I was going to most of the time. And I was busy, and I was working, and I was trying to be successful. And my wife and I began to fight a lot about kids and about money and about even AA, because she don't know how to work a program. I just decided she didn't quite have a handle on it. Now, she's sober 3 years longer than I am. And she calls me the newcomer. And she used to look at me and say, you jerk. If I ask you to get me a cup of coffee, you got to do it, mudhead. She didn't have a handle on it, I decided. Didn't understand me. She put a lot of pressure on me, a lot of anxiety. The kids were not shaping up, drinking, using drugs, some of them. It's not fair. The ratings were not moving. Things were not moving along the way they should have. My bosses were looking at me funny in New York. I was beginning to get very scared and very uptight and very nervous, and nobody was helping. Everybody was just crazy. I sat down and I talked to a man with 18 years of sobriety one night, and I told him how bad it was. And he sat there and listened to me, and he finally looked at me and he says, how many meetings do you go to? And I knew he hadn't listened. I said, what the hell's that got to do with anything, meetings? I'm busy here. I'm trying to be a success. You know what I'm doing here? I'm trying to make it in my life. Just make it. I've got time for meetings. I'm fine. I haven't had a drink in 2.5 years. He said, how many newcomers do you work with? I said, well, I never been any good at that. Every newcomer I ever worked with got drunk. And I haven't met any newcomers on the East Coast anyway. He says, yeah, I know. They go to those meetings you don't attend. He says, what are you doing about the third step? And I told him, I said, well, I've always had a lot of trouble with that God thing. You know, I can't deal with that in the way that some of you do. But I never have gotten a handle on God, and I don't expect to. It's just not my thing. So I told him about all the alcoholics around the world staying sober together. And he said, how's it working for you today? I said, that crap doesn't work. It just gets you to step four. I don't know. You work? That's podium talk, man. You talk about AA and the steps and all that stuff. It's just crap. If you want to know the truth, it doesn't work at all. Because in the real world that I live in, it's dog eat dog, tear them apart, get rich and famous, and be the richest man in the cemetery. And it's painful and it's agony and it's hard. Every day. He said, I think you got to go to more meetings. And he said, I think you have to start working with newcomers because they may save your life. And he said, finally, I think what you're going to have to do is start to pray. And I said, I cannot pray because it makes me feel like a phony. And he said, that's all right, you are a phony. And I admitted that to him. He said, so say a phony prayer. And I said, to a phony God? He said, sure. Take the action in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you believe in it or not. He says it twice, it's probably important. Take the action in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you believe in it or not. Now, I've been doing that a lot of ways, and I had had a drink, and that seemed successful. So I thought, okay, I'll do the prayer thing. So I start going to meetings, and I start grabbing newcomers and threatening them. You call me at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Some of them did. And some of them really threw me a curve because they stayed sober. And I don't know what the hell to do with them when they're sober. Come over to your house and drive their Mercedes up to the front door and ask you to work step three. And you got to say, I don't know, I never tried that one. But I was working to go to meetings. Doing the best I could to get along with that wife of mine. Doing the best I could with the kids. Trying to struggle through. Working with newcomers. Saying that stupid prayer. And I got fired. I came back to California and I moved into San Diego. It was the only place I could get a job. I went to work at a little station down there for a lot less money than I was used to making. And I was beneath my dignity. But I went to work and I worked there for about a year or so. And then I quit that job one day. It just wasn't up to my standards. And San Diego wasn't going to be the be-all and the end-all anyway. And I had to figure out how to make a move, and I had to figure out how to be successful, and I didn't know how to do it. And I quit the job, and I went in the tower of my house in La Jolla, and looked at the ocean a lot. I had a piece of paper and a pencil and a typewriter, and I sat there and I looked at the ocean and I thought about it all. And I decided I was screwed. I just couldn't seem to get it together. I couldn't do anything right. I couldn't be successful. By that time, I was 6.5 years sober. I was sponsoring guys that were in a lot better shape than I was. I was about half crazy. I didn't know what the hell to do. My wife looked at me one day and she said, are you going to get a job? And I said, I don't know. She said, I think you are the biggest loser I've ever met. So I'm going to divorce you. And I thought, okay, why not? And I thought about her, and I thought about the jobs, and I thought about success and fame, and I didn't have none of that stuff. And I was broke again, and I was getting behind in the mortgage payments again. And I was 6.5 years sober, and you're not supposed to feel that way, 6.5 years sober. I failed as an alcoholic. I failed as a member of AA. I wasn't wonderful and spiritual, and I wasn't really anything. I was tired again. I went out and I walked on the beach that night. I was walking around and I was saying that stupid prayer. And I thought, what are you doing that for? You don't believe in anything. Why do you say that prayer? And so just a split second on that beach, and it was about midnight and it was March. I was the only one out there. I thought, geez, I wonder, is it possible there could possibly be anybody? Is it possible that God exists? And that thought ran through my head, and just for a split second I thought, well, USOB, I give up. I just decided to quit everything. Screw them all. Can't make it. Can't be successful. I can't be a father. Can't be a husband. Can't do nothing right. Now, if I knew that night that I was surrendering, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I think that's what happened. I had surrendered my right to drink 6.5 years earlier. What I had never surrendered was all the rest of my life. And I think that night I did, because I decided I'm just going to go get any stupid job and I don't care about it anymore. I can't be anything anyway. Screw it. I'll just take the first dumb job that comes along and I'll care how much money I make, and I'll just try to raise the kids, and she's going to divorce me and I'll lose my house, and it's okay. I don't care. I'll go sell tacos in Laguna Beach if I have to. I'll just go get a dumb job and I'll just try to show up every day and look reasonably alert, because it's all I got left. And I took a job as a reporter back up here in Los Angeles at Channel 7. Now, I used to be the anchor man in that place. And that was hard to do. But it was a job. And I took it, and I started showing up. And I had 24-year-old assignment editors who didn't remember me when I was wonderful, handing me assignments and saying, you think you can handle that? And I just look at them and say, I'll give it the best shot I got. And I began to just do what they asked me to do and stop fighting with them and stop arguing with them and stop trying to run the world. And beyond everything else, stop trying to be rich and famous, because I knew I was never going to make that anyway. Strange thing about that is that it wasn't too long after that they handed me a 5-year contract for an awful lot of money. I didn't ask them for it. 5 years later, I got another contract for a lot of money. I didn't ask them for it. I just went over there and showed up and looked alert. I'm still in the same joint. I just show up now in the morning and try to do the best I can with what I've got. And I know that isn't much, but most days it seems to work okay. Because I'm not trying to prove anything to anybody. I have absolutely nothing to prove anymore. And I feel reasonably successful today. And it ain't got nothing to do with stuff. It has to do with how I feel about me, about you, and about AA. I do the same thing at home that I do at work. I just show up and look alert. Because I can't make her happy, I know that, I tried. And I can't make her love me, I tried. And I can't make her nothing, because she's going to do what she wants to do. And she's got her own AA deal, and she does it very well. She's become the Mother Cabrini of AA in La Jolla, you know. Oh, Carol! You're so wonderful. But she's doing a hell of a job, and she's a marvelous, marvelous member of AA, and she wouldn't come up in front of one of these podiums. She's 18 years sober. She would no more talk in front of one of these podiums than the man in the moon. But one-on-one, oh, baby, does she do AA. And she's got meetings going that she's started down there, and she's involved in and been secretaries, and she's a hell of a member of AA. We just do it differently, that's all. I just run my mouth a lot. But I'll tell you something, I have reached a point in Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I'm 50 years old now. I'm sober almost 15 years. And I'm reasonably comfortable most of the time. I feel okay. You know, I just feel all right. I feel level a good part of the time. It's unusual for me. I don't feel frightened very often anymore. My anxiety level goes up, but not too damn high. And then it comes back down again. And I have, you know, most days are really pretty good if I just kind of get out of the way. It's all right. I have finally, in some peculiar way that I can't even explain to you, come to believe that some power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. He hasn't done it yet, but I believe he can. And I have stuff today. I got stuff. I got a house, I got cars, I got clothes, I got things. My kids are doing wonderfully well. The oldest boy is sober 5.5 years in AA. We've got two girls that are sitting here tonight. They're working in production here in television and in Los Angeles and commercials and doing extremely well. We have a son who's selling time for Turner Broadcasting. Nobody's perfect. Our oldest boy is married to an alcoholic, and they have a little daughter, and we're grandparents now. And we have a son who's pitching professional baseball in the minor leagues. I got traded yesterday. But he's a Met now. And the way their pitches are going, he may be up there pretty soon. Keep running him into the hospitals. I'm fine. I'm comfortable. And I have stuff and I have things and I have hope and I have love in my life and I'm fine today. But I had all of those things and damn near died drunk with those things. Lost them all. I had them all again sober and lost them all. So I believe that the God that I've come to try to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous has enough of a sense of humor that if any of my stuff ever gets that important to me again, he may take it away from me again, just to get my attention. If you're new here tonight, look, I don't know. I used to think there was some wonderful message in AA that you could deliver, the message. And everybody would rise at the end and link arms and stay sober forever, But I know that doesn't happen here. But I do believe this. I've been sober all day today, and now almost 15 years, and that, I think, is the message. And anybody in this room who hasn't had a drink today, that's the message. I believe we have a room full of messages here, and all over the world we have other rooms full of messages every night. That's the message. So stick around. Put your ass in the chair and leave your head outside. You'll be fine.